You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants, and together we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today, we're talking about real cliffhangers here. Pun intended, because the group of plants we're featuring today largely live on cliffs. We're talking about the rock daisies in the genus Peridolii. And joining us to discuss this incredible group of plants is Isaac Mark. He's a PhD student at UC Berkeley, and he has been devoting much of his time to studying the evolutionary radiations of this incredible genus of plants. They have a lot to teach us about evolution, and some of the insights he gains from studying their relationships are incredible. But then when you think about all of the work that goes into actually finding and locating and collecting these plants to study them, it's incredible stuff. Before we get to that conversation, I have one quick announcement. I was lucky enough to be a guest on a new podcast called Wild Green Streams for Ecological Fiends. It is a spin-off podcast from the famous meme page, Wild Green Memes for Ecological Fiends, and it was a lot of fun to talk to those guys. So go check it out. Again, that's Wild Green Streams for Ecological Fiends. And yeah, you'll get to hear a little bit about my own research, stuff that I'm doing on a day-to-day basis when I'm not podcasting or photographing plants. But yeah, I really thank those guys for inviting me on, and go give it a listen. Let them know Indefensive Plants sent you. All right, that's entirely enough out of me. Let's head on over to my conversation with Isaac and learn a little bit about the incredible world of rock daisies. I hope you enjoy. All right, Isaac, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
So my name is Isaac Mark. I am a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley, where I work in the University and Jetson Herbarium. And I study the compositae for their incredible diversity and ecology. I'm interested in plant evolution and ecology.
Awesome. And were you always a plant person, or is this something you kind of came to later as your education was forging ahead?
So I've always been into natural history, and plants have been the group that I've always gravitated towards. But I've also had, you know, side obsessions with caterpillars and mushrooms and birds and all types of insects. And for me, the thing that I really get into, whether I'm studying, you know, any one of those groups, are the ecological specialists. So the things that hide, that are hard to find or hard to identify.
Interesting to put it in that context. And I like the idea of specialists, because from an evolutionary perspective, there's a lot to learn from there. But then from just a naturalist perspective, like you said, they're kind of hidden, they're different, they're obscure, they're often the oddballs of the families, and they're just fun.
Yeah, they often have the most interesting evolutionary stories to tell. And then also, you know, the state that we're in the world, where we're losing species at an ever-increasing rate, these are often groups that have a lot of unrecognized diversity. So,
right.
You know, what I'm really interested in is trying to just document and describe the lives of these things before they go extinct.
Right on. So what brought you to working on plants specifically, though? I mean, there's a lot of different specialists out there from all walks of life.
Well, plants, they're very sensitive to minute changes in climate and geography that might be hard to understand or perceive otherwise. So I'm really into plants because, using the tools of molecular phylogenetics and ecology, you can study a group of plants across the landscape and read out the information that they have stored in their DNA in order to learn about the landscapes where they live.
And I'm really excited to unpack that, because it's in a way, it's kind of eerie, because it's like, oh, there's information buried there that, you know, it took a lot of things to figure out. But it's also really exciting, because you can tell a story with these molecular approaches, which is so interesting to me, because you get big picture ideas out of molecular studies, right?
Yeah, it's a new technique, right? But the idea that plants store knowledge about landscapes is an old idea that people have been practicing for thousands of years. And the new tools are amazing, because now with precision, you can study an area like an island system or like a mountain And you can understand where the plants that live there came from or how long they've been there and learn about the landscape itself. And you can also make predictions about what that landscape might look like in the future.
Awesome. So you said compositae, and I know what you're talking about, but many people will not. It's harkening back to an old school day of thinking about this family of plants. But what do you mean when you say compositae in a more strict sense?
So compositae are the sunflowers and daisies. And it's a very diverse family that it has a cosmopolitan distribution worldwide. And I use the word compositae, although they're often called Asteraceae. So Asteraceae refers to aster, a star, you know, because the disc corolla of the florets that are found in the central part of many composite flowers have five lobes. And so they kind of look like a star when you look at them face on. But I study a tribe within the compositae that has a corolla that is split into four lobes. It's kind of like cruciform.
Hmm.
So the aster title doesn't apply so well, and that's why I choose to use compositae.
I like that.
Yeah, compositae also makes a lot of sense because this is a family of plants that have inflorescences made up of many florets. So the flower, the classic sunflower, is actually a composite of many smaller florets. Those can be strap-shaped, like the ones around the outside that are kind of like, that look like rays, or they can be disc-shaped, like the ones on the inside of a sunflower, which open in a helical pattern that corresponds with a Fibonacci sequence and are specialized for different purposes, attraction or for production of fruits.
Yeah, and it's timely that we're having this conversation. This will be released, you know, in the early days of fall when a lot of people in our northern hemisphere are starting to recognize all of the different composite flowers out there. And there's a lot of diversity beyond what we see in your normal everyday going to and from work, you know, in fallow fields or in pockets tucked around suburban and urban areas. But you study a very specific group, right?
Yeah, so if you live in North America, in the northern hemisphere, then probably the sunflowers that you're used to are more classic sunflowers, and it makes sense that they open late in the season in the fall, because many of these are part of a subgroup within the family, the North American sunflowers, the Helianthe alliance, that has its biogeographic origins in Mesoamerica, and it was probably, you know, it probably evolved in a habitat where it was responding to summer rains. And that's why they have a blooming period so late in the season.
Oh.
The area that I study is in the desert areas of Western North America, because the distribution of the tribe, the rock daisies, Peridili, extends from northwest Mexico and includes a mountain range called the Sierra Madre Occidental, and includes the North American deserts, the Chihuahuan Desert, the Sonoran Desert, and the Great Basin Desert, as well as Baja California.
Spanning some really interesting biogeography with that.
Yeah, I always gravitated towards the deserts, because when you open a textbook about biology, one of the first things that you learn is that life is wet. You know, we evolved in the water and we are made of water. So one of the greatest accomplishments of life on Earth, in my opinion, is the ability to live in hot, dry desert habitats.
I like that.
Yeah, the weird thing, though, about the deserts is that they have this incredibly diverse and endemic flora, including, you know, those incredible wildflower blooms that you see pictures of that happen after a good rain. All of these things take advantage of that period of wet climate. But the desert ecosystem is actually one that's pretty young in terms of geological age. So the Earth has been cooling and drying up over the last 30 million years. And desert habitats are relatively new on the scene. And actually, widespread deserts, you know, as we know them, they didn't really exist before 5 to 8 million years ago. And they didn't reach the huge extent that they are now, at least in North America, before, you know, 2 million years ago.
Huh.
So it's a really interesting evolutionary question. Where did all of these diverse endemic desert lineages come from? And where did their adaptations to living in the desert come from, given that they've had such a short time?
Wow, that's fascinating. And I didn't even really fully grasp the extent to which deserts really are relatively recent habitats, and all of these radiations that's happened in them are in turn also relatively recent. And it is really good to know that, and it's good for people to hear that, that there is strange diversity going on in desert habitats, because it's one theme I hear time and time again is in classes with students, even with naturalists and all across the board. You talk about biodiversity and everyone instantly beelines to talking about the tropics and the rainforest for good reason. There's a ton of life down there, but that's placing it in just a numbers game. This one has more than this one kind of devalues the fact that deserts are full of strange and unique organisms, of which the rock daisies are one.
Yeah, and also the deserts are not a homogeneous habitat. So if you look at North America on a map and you look at Western North America, you'll see it's much more wrinkly than the eastern half. And that's because what makes Western North America unique is the topography, a pattern of basin and range topography where you have, valleys or badlands of desert separated by mountain ranges. And many of those mountain ranges harbor cool mesic habitats on top. And that's why they're called sky islands. The sky islands, they're also really interesting because, island systems are really good for studying evolution and for understanding the mechanisms of evolution. And in places like oceanic islands or islands of alpine habitat in the tropics, like in the Andes, there's all of these incredible examples of plant radiations, like the silver swords or Espalidia. But the sky islands and the deserts in Western North America, they're less studied from that kind of perspective. And so there's not really characteristic radiations that come to mind. And part of that makes sense if you think about these pockets of mesic, wet habitat on top of the mountains where you see oaks and pines. Well, over the last 200,000 years and more than that, there's been so much climate change going on in these habitats that those plants have cycled down into the valleys and then back up to the mountaintops many, many times. And actually, the current state of things where you have hot, dry deserts down in the lowlands and then wet habitats kind of isolated on top has only been the case for a small proportion of most of that time. So a lot of people have actually, they've been skeptical, and rightfully so, that the sky islands in Western North America have harbored or could harbor, diverse plant radiations. But there's other things besides climate that contribute to insularity in plants. And one thing to understand about the way the sky island regions of Western North America were formed is kind of different from sky islands elsewhere, because it happened through a geologic process called faulting and extension.
Okay.
Where there was kind of like a heterogeneous layer cake of rock, the kind of thing you can see if you go to the Grand Canyon and hike down through the eroded canyon. You pass through all of these different layers of rock. And those were lifted up in different places, kind of like a tilting sort of motion. And so the mountains themselves are made of this incredible mosaic of different rock types. You have mountains that are volcanic in origin, next to mountains that are pure limestone, and others that are a crazy melange of many different layers of rock. And just really cool to explore and find, little pockets of really interesting rock types. But that also, you can imagine, is an incredible kind of backdrop for any plant that has specific edaphic affinities, specializations to particular rock types on which to diversify.
Wow. What a playground for evolution to start working. And I'm really happy you just set the stage for thinking about these sorts of things, because so much of it does have to do with geology and rock types and the biogeographical history of climate even, and how that has shifted and changed. And it really paints a more complete story when you think about it in the bigger context, instead of saying like, oh, it's weird, we have some soil endemics over here and some over here and they're kind of close now, but were they, you get so much more of a complete story that way.
Yeah. And it also seems important to mention that although the climate has been changing drastically really recently, these rock types might have been consistently isolated for long periods of time. So they might actually be better isolationary forces for evolution to take place on. But that different types of rocks also impose different types of selective pressures on plants. So limestone, for example, is really high in calcium compared to volcanic or metamorphic rocks.
Sure.
But then there's also huge variety in kind of in the actual texture of the rocks. So limestone erodes in a very different way from other types of rocks. It gives a formation called karst, which you can kind of think of as really steep limestone cliffs. Mm-hmm. Limestone mountains tend to have really steep vertical rock cliffs. You know, actually, a lot of the rock formations of the southwest U.S. and northern Mexico are iconic when you think about the desert. But the plants that live on them are not really actually well known, even though there's a whole assemblage of specialized plants in the desert that are found only on those kind of vertical rock environments.
Yeah, and I can imagine, you know, ease of getting there, ease of finding them. You know, there's a lot of reasons probably why they've been a little bit more obscure than some of the more charismatic plant species that are usually used to teach these sorts of things. But, you know, you specialize in this group called the rock daisies. Why rock daisies?
So this is a really cool group for exploring the kinds of questions that we're talking about here and for understanding sort of desert evolution and ecology, because the rock daisies they're a diverse group. First of all, there's about 85-84 species described. Wow. and it's a tribe, an entire tribe, and within the Helianthe alliance in the family Compositae. And it's a monophyletic group, and they're well defined by the morphological characteristic that I mentioned earlier. They all have a four-lobed disc corolla, which is not unheard of in the family, but pretty rare within the Compositae.
Mm-hmm.
And their range kind of extends throughout this whole desert region and on these different sky islands, as well as these low deserts, as well as the big mountain range in northwest Mexico, Sierra Madre Occidental. But first of all, they're a really important part ecologically, and this is how they first kind of caught my eye, in these ephemeral wildflower blooms that you can go see in the Colorado Desert in California, around Anza Borrego, or around Tucson, or in Sonora. And there's a particular species, Pyridale emeryi, the first one that kind of caught my eye, that's really widespread. It germinates, grows, flowers, goes to seed in as little as a month in response to ephemeral rains. And it kind of joins in with a whole group of other annuals that exploit that little window of good habitat. But there's also, within this group, several other species that follow that same kind of ecology. They're sort of exploiting the ephemeral good habitat. And the reason, though, that these are called the rock daisies, something I learned when I got, you know, deeper into this group, is that the majority of the diversity is not widespread at all, but restricted onto those particular vertical rock cliffs that I mentioned earlier. So they're suffratescent or woody, you know, kind of succulent or woody perennial plants that are rooted into the crevices and cracks in vertical cliffs. And usually we're talking about cliffs that are larger than 15 feet, but often, you know, as high as 200 feet.
Oh.
And they grow on a variety of different substrates, you know, limestone and volcanic, and also are very diverse in terms of their morphology. So this is a group with a good amount of diversity, maybe about 50-55 species, and they're distributed throughout the Sierra Madre and the Sky Island region. And a lot of them have characteristics that sort of suggest a history of island-like diversification. There's a lot of examples of Pyridale is the genus that we're referring to. There's a lot of examples of Pyridale that are isolated onto one particular, you know, mountain island.
Huh.
And there's a lot of risk involved for the kind of lifestyle that they have. If you're only able to live on these vertical rock cliffs and your seeds disperse off of the rock cliff, then they'll die. So there are even some plants that show adaptations, or you could call them presumed adaptations, for keeping fruits from dispersing far off the rock cliff.
Oh.
So in Sonora, there's actually a plant there called Pyridale reinana. That's named after my friend Ana Lilia Reina, who's been collecting plants in Sonora for decades. And this plant is restricted to one particular sky island called the Sierra de Mazatán, which is shaped like a birthday cake and found, you know, outside of Hermosillo. And the plant grows on granite rocks, and it's found only on the rocks. And, you know, it has this same kind of danger from dispersing off the rocks. But as the inflorescence, you know, opens up and the fruits begin to mature, the pedicel of the flower bends back and it actually plants the seeds back into the rock.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in thinking about island evolution, there's been a lot of debate about the idea that island plants and animals suffer from a similar kind of fate, right? If they disperse off an island, they end up in the ocean and they die.
Right.
That, you know, that's presumably why you end up with things like flightless cormorants in the Galapagos and other places too. But with plants, it's really hard to say because, you know, dispersibility of seeds is usually pretty correlated with seed size and other things like that.
Sure.
Which are also under a lot of selection when you disperse to an island. But I've been thinking about this, but I haven't thought of something that could be confounding this kind of effect of these cliff plants that plant themselves back into the rock.
Right.
And it's a cool kind of ecological, you know, behavior, you could call it, that's exhibited by other plants that are endemic to rock cliffs, including Euconite, the rock nettle. I should say that it's an observation. It hasn't been tested as to whether it's effective in keeping the plants from dispersing off the rock, but it's a cool hypothesis that was originally called to my attention by John Redman, who's worked on Baja for a long time.
Yeah.
And observed this happening in Pirtle lobata, a plant that is found in Baja, California.
Yeah, that's wild. And I mean, I grew up in Western New York where it's not necessarily like Grand Canyon style cliffs, but there are gorges carved out by rivers. They are limestone. And it is interesting to look up at these really treacherous looking cliff faces that would kill a human trying to get up there. But there are plants up there, and you always go like, how the heck are you making a living up there? But it does make sense. And it's one of those things that obviously, you know, experimentation and all that will have to go on to prove. But it is neat to think about, again, just the corollaries between specializing in a small area of land, whether it's surrounded by water or surrounded by just sheer uninhabitable land surface, what that does to an organism.
Yeah. And also, where do these adaptations for that kind of life come from? Because living on a rock face anywhere, whether it's New York or in the tropics, is going to be difficult because as a plant, you're going to be exposed, you know, to full on UV radiation, and you're going to have to deal with disturbance. You know, if there is some kind of big windstorm or environmental disturbance, you're going to be fully exposed to it. But also, you know, probably the rock cliffs themselves are very dynamic and always kind of eroding and crumbling. So a lot of these plants, you know, including Pirtle, but also other plants that live on rock faces, they show characteristics in the leaves that protect them from UV radiation, like they're hairy, they're bearded. Oftentimes they have these really, you know, tufted, cool to look at canescent hairs that reflect light. And then other ones have glands that help to keep the leaves from drying out too quick. But there's also another thing here, which is that if you're exposed on a rock cliff, you're very visible, and you're also very visible to herbivores and to other things that want to come and eat you. So being a parent and being found on this stressful environment, you know, it makes you want to protect your herbage from any kind of enemy. Anything you lose is going to be very valuable. So a lot of these plants, if you take the leaves and you smell them, they're very aromatic. That probably has to do with them having a really active secondary metabolite chemistry to protect them from herbivores.
Yeah, all of those chemicals being real nasty or even potentially toxic, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they end up being very nice smelling, very beautifully fuzzy, interesting plants that are, you know, they look like little mats growing on these rock faces. And the rock faces themselves are also very photogenic and beautiful places to be. And I mention all of these ecological aspects, but really, they're all kind of hand-wavy hypotheses. And if they've been tested, they've probably been tested in only a few plants and not in the types of habitats where these plants live. So part of studying these plants is getting to get in there and find out whether these ideas really hold water.
Yeah, and that's a good point to make, is a lot of times, you know, especially we like a good story, and if you're in a naturalist type setting or you're just trying to understand the world, these things ring true and they sound really good and they make a lot of sense. But yeah, especially when it comes to plants and lesser known groups for that matter, the amount that's actually been tested and we have good data on versus the amount of stories we have don't always match up. So it is important that people are out there in the field trying to understand these in situ and back in the lab. You know, that's where we can either confirm or disprove some of this stuff.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, you know, groups like this are still very unknown. And so Pyridyl has actually been studied in the past. There's a pretty good monograph of this group from the 1970s.
Oh.
It was done by Michael Powell from Sul Ross State University in West Texas. And he spent decades actually exploring the Southwest, collecting these plants and trying to describe the different species and taxa based on their morphology. And in a series of papers that he published in the late 60s, actually early 70s, he made hypotheses about the evolutionary history of the group and also about some of the phylogenetic relationships among the plants, even though this study predated kind of formal phylogenetics as we know it now.
Mm-hmm.
It's really advanced in terms of thinking about the relationships between certain mountain islands based on the morphology of the plants found there and their similarity.
That's cool.
Yeah, they're really cool to read. The monograph on Pyridyl is really great. But since that point, there's been very little about these plants researched or published besides descriptions of new species, because it's a group that's not well collected given how hard they are to kind of to access the environments where they live. If you go up a sky island where there's few collections, you could very possibly discover a new species of these. And so there's been more than 10 recent species described in this group. Many of those have been from Mexico, from the Sierra Madre Occidental, but others have been, you know, from the U.S. and also from Sonora and Chihuahua.
That's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a group that is not well known, but at the same time, the environments where they live, these cathedrals of vertical rocks on the tops of desert mountain ranges, they often harbor little north-facing cliffs where there's little microhabitats of wet climate. And that's where the plants tend to be found. They're kind of like isolated there. And I don't really know if many of those habitats will survive, you know, the next 50 years of climate change. So I've sort of approached studying this group with that sort of mentality, in order to document as much as possible and also when possible to cultivate these plants with the very, very real possibility that these habitats might disappear very soon. And, you know, I guess I started out sort of ambitious, but just understanding the most basic aspects of the evolutionary history of the rock daisies has taken a lot of effort, but there's some really interesting stories.
Sure. I can imagine. You know, none of this is easy, and we all start out eager and ambitious with these sorts of questions in mind, but reality, especially if the reality is a cliff face across a wide swath of the North American continent, that's intense. So in thinking about it, you know, enter you. It's been a while since anyone's really looked at this. You're probably giving it the most attention it's had, or at least you and a couple others are giving it the most attention this group has had since the 70s. So what is your field work like? I mean, how do you go about trying to answer some of the questions you've set out to trying to answer?
So I've done a lot of field work on this group, and the way I've sort of approached it was just to kind of sweep across the geographic range of the plants in Western North America in a series of road trips and using kind of like an old, you know, high clearance four-wheel drive Toyota truck to navigate these badlands and make it to different mountain ranges. And then climbing those mountains until, you know, I reach suitable habitat where the plants are growing. And then once I'm there, I lack formal rock climbing training and I don't carry any technical rock climbing gear because I feel like it probably would make things more dangerous.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time, you know, moving across the talus slopes at the base of these big rock cliffs, hoping that I'll find a rock daisy that's in flower and low enough for me to study.
Wow.
So I guess in climber speak, the most that I'll do is called class four. It's kind of just scrambling around. And, I've done a lot of this field work alone, but I've also done a lot of it with a list of helpers, which could fill up several pages. And especially because this is a group that's found on both sides of the US-Mexico border, the project has turned into a binational collaboration of many botanists in the Southwest US and also in Mexico, where I've worked closely with Jesus Sanchez, the curator in Hermosillo at the University of Sonora, and Marcelo Ruiz in Mazatlan, Pablo Carrillo Reyes in Guadalajara, Arturo Castro Castro in Durango, and Jose Delgadillo in Baja California. And I've also received a lot of help in Texas from Michael Powell himself and other botanists in Arizona, including Robert Villa, Tom Van Devender, and Ana Lilia Reyna, and Wendy Hodgson, and Raul Puente. And there's so many other people I could mention. I could go on forever. I really appreciate all the people who have been willing to go to these places and risk their lives with me. But it's not all, you know, it's not always that sketchy.
Sure.
And oftentimes, you know, the worst part is actually people. So in the Southwest, in these old Western movies, is kind of like a frontier zone. Yeah. And it still is to a certain extent. You don't know who you're going to meet out there. You could run into, you know, crooked border patrol agents or vigilantes in old beat up trucks with guns. There's plenty of, you know, rogue police officers and bandits and coyotes. And then there's also people you meet who are just moving through this landscape, often desperately poor and trying to move north. And you have to be prepared, you know, carry whatever you can to help people out and also, you know, to protect yourself. But for me, protecting myself, my strategy is just to have a big smile on my face. Be nice to everybody, you know, offer to help out whenever possible. And that's actually been pretty good of a strategy.
Yeah, botanists aren't generally the target for a lot of things, but you never know. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, obviously you're here talking to us today. A big smile goes a long way.
Yeah. And then there's also the non-human animals, which are really common on the slopes leading up to the rock cliffs, and especially the rattlesnakes. So I'm not sure actually how many species of rattlesnakes there are in the Southwest, but there's a huge diversity of these snakes, and they're really common on the rocky environments. Mm-hmm. So you see them very often and they often surprise you. And at first I was pretty scared of them, but I've kind of learned to love them. And they're kind of like, you know, my friends up on the rocks.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, you know, whoever thinks plants and studying plants could be boring just needs to talk to people like you, because it's obviously not. But in thinking about this fieldwork, you know, when you say, I hope to find a Peridolia in bloom and to study it, you know, what does that mean? What happens when you finally do go, yes, here we go, I found them. They're within arm's reach. I don't have to break my neck getting to them. What does it mean to study these plants, both in situ and then once you get back to the laboratory?
So at this point, the aspects of the evolutionary history of these plants that I'm really trying to get a grapple on involves their evolutionary relationships and their ecology, as well as their historical kind of biogeography. So when I encounter a plant, I'll collect herbarium specimens if I can. I'll also collect leaf material on silica for DNA analysis. And then I'll collect rock samples of the substrate that they're living on. And I'm trying my best also to really clear up what the distribution of each of these plants are. So I'm interested in, you know, if there's a weird record of a plant where it's not supposed to be, then I'll investigate that too. So I can really get a handle on the distribution of each of these plants. And in terms of the geology, the you know, when I collect rock samples, I'm interested in a couple different things, but mainly I'm interested in the texture of the rock that they're living on. So whether they're living on a solid, bare rock surface, or whether they're found down in, you know, down in low environments on gravel and sand. And then I'm also interested in the chemistry of the rock. So I'll bring rocks back to the lab, and you know, we'll use like hydrochloric acid. We'll drop a little bit on the rock and see if it has a calcareous content. The leaf tissue on silica is really important for molecular phylogenetic approaches, which is something I've been focusing on a lot lately. And so far, the approach that I've taken is called genome skimming, and it's a kind of next generation sequencing technique.
Nice.
What you do is you basically, you extract DNA from the leaf tissue, And then you use a machine called a sonicator that plays a sound on the DNA at a particular frequency to chop it up into small fragments. Huh. And then you shotgun sequence all of those little fragments on a machine that is very expensive called the HiSeq 4000.
Ooh.
And then, you know, you have kind of just all of these little 150 to 300 base pair fragments of DNA that you then reassemble using, you know, using a reference, in my case, the Helianthus annuus, you know, the classic sunflower genome.
Nice.
And from that, you can use bioinformatics to get the chloroplast genome, the entire chloroplast genome, as well as the ribosomal cistron, which is the part of the DNA that includes ITS1, ITS2, ETS, and then, you know, this long non-coding region that's really useful for figuring out relationships.
I see. So that's kind of how you piece together these family trees then, is looking at how much these fragments compare to this, and how much do they share versus don't share. You can kind of piece together a tree once you have all of that.
Yeah, so you use a particular type of statistics, either maximum likelihood or Bayesian statistical inference, to put together, you know, these big data sets of DNA. And out of that, based on, you know, a model of how DNA evolves and on assumptions about the frequency of certain DNA bases and everything, you get a hypothesis about relationships among the different rock daisies found on different mountain islands and low deserts.
Cool.
Yeah.
So in thinking about the biogeography and the kind of questions you want to ask, I mean, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that the history of this lineage is often written in the DNA, or at least something like that. You know, do you have resolution at this point? I mean, do you know where some of these plants might have begun or where the radiations are have happened more recently? I mean, what kind of stories are you starting to put together with this data?
Well, as I mentioned, these are plants that are distributed in this mountain range called the Sierra Madre Occidental in northwest Mexico, as well as the deserts of North America and Baja California. And I always knew that the Sierra Madre Occidental was an interesting kind of biogeographic region because it has a really high density of all of these really interesting, often monotypic groups of sunflowers. And actually, Powell, in his original monograph of this group, hypothesized that it was, you know, an area of biogeographic origin for these plants because there's a lot of diversity there. So in my fieldwork, I made it a point to visit this mountain range, and I spent about 3 months finding ways to get into habitat in that mountain range and collect plants and include them in the study. And so what I find is that the Pyridale and Pyridale allies in this tribe that are found in the Baja California Peninsula form sort of like a grade that is sister to the rest of those plants found in the Sierra Madre Occidental and the Sky Island region. That's kind of interesting because Baja California has a biogeographic history where it was kind of like a piece of land that was sloughed off of lowland, you know, central Mexico a long time ago. So it kind of suggests that there may have been some ancestry in these lowland environments in transitional Mexico. But then within the rest of the group, which there are two distinct clades that are resolved. One that includes most of the plants of the Sierra Madre Occidental, and a lot of these plants tend to have rays, the strap-like petals on the outside of the flower of the inflorescence, that are white. And then there's actually a distinct clade that corresponds to most of the diversity in the Sky Island, and a lot of those have yellow rays, or they lack rays altogether. But both of those groups are united by having a chromosome number that's pretty similar. And if you use the recent studies that are coming out on the Compositae family by Jen Mandel and Vicky Funk and others that bring in several fossils in order to get dates on the different major diversification events in this family, what you find is that most of the rock daisy lineages that split happen in accordance with major geological events, including the volcanic events that led to the rise of the Sierra Madre Occidental, and then also the faulting and extension that sets up the basin and range topology of Western North America. But they predate the spread of the desert climate. So it's kind of interesting. It suggests that this is this is a radiation that's actually older than recent climate change in the deserts.
Wow. And so kind of suggests that this popping up of these desert climates and the spreading of them just really unlocked a whole new set of places for them to get into, after they'd already conquered a lot of territory.
Yeah, what it appears from, you know, looking at the historical biogeography is that this was a lineage that was established in the Sierra Madre Occidental, but that experienced repeated dispersals out of the Sierra Madre Occidental into the Sky Island region of Western North America. And that included ones that happened more than 15 million years ago with the beginning of the faulting and extension, as well as subsequent kind of dispersals into the Great Basin, Sonoran, and Chihuahuan deserts, where there's kind of like sub-radiations of rock daisies under the different mountain islands.
Cool.
And then there's actually later dispersals out of the Sierra Madre Occidental of completely a different lineage of rock daisies that then comes and establishes another diversification in Sonora.
Huh. That's wild. That is not what I was expecting when we started this conversation. And I'm sure you were probably equally as like, what the heck?
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's really interesting because it suggests that a lot of the diversity that you see in the deserts comes from movement north out of these mountain ranges in northwest Mexico. And it does make a lot of sense because those are really biodiverse areas where the New World tropics and dry climates and temperate climates meet. Mm. So it's kind of like a mixing ground of all of these different lineages, where you have tropical environments showing up as little bubbles of microhabitat in Sonoran desert scrub. And then you have alpine habitats running like a backbone down into the neotropics.
Wow.
So I was interested to see in studying the plants that found down in these frost-free kind of tropical environments, whether they were more like the ones found in the low deserts that are annuals and kind of take advantage of little ephemeral rains, mm-hmm. or whether they were more like the rock dwellers found on the large cliffs.
And?
So I reconstructed those two things, you know, it's basically just the difference in texture, whether they're found on bare rock habitats or on gravel or soil. And I found that the rock dwelling habit is actually ancestral in this group, but that there's multiple transitions within different clades to a kind of lowland desert habit of being found on soil and gravel. So that's kind of interesting. It suggests that there's been kind of like a movement down off of the rocks and that this has happened in lots of disparate geographic areas. And it's kind of interesting because those movements down off of the rocks actually correspond well in terms of the timing with the spread of desert habitats.
That's so cool. And it's kind of like paints this picture almost as like these biodiversity hotspots or zones that act as like feeder areas for the surrounding landscape to kind of, you know, have plants that can experiment, so to speak, with different lifestyles. And like you said, these repeated events just show that, like, provided the situation is right and the moment, you know, all the serendipity of life comes together, they can take advantage of these things and have done so repeatedly.
Yeah, it's a bit weird to discover a population of one of these plants in the desert, to visit it, and you see these plants growing on the rocks, but you don't see them growing down off of the rocks, even though there's plenty of suitable, you know, habitat there. And actually, if you take these plants, if you take seeds, or you take cuttings, and you grow them in soil in the greenhouse, they do fine. So it's a bit perplexing why they're isolated onto the rock faces in the first place. And if you go in and you look at studies of edaphic specialization, what you'll see is that oftentimes the plants that are restricted to rock substrates like that are poor competitors off of the rocks.
Right.
And so they're kind of stuck there because, you know, they get outcompeted if they try to come down off the rocks. And it never really made much sense to me looking at the rock daisies in the deserts. But if you go down to these frost-free kind of tropical deciduous forests down in southern Sonora or Sinaloa in the southern Sierra Madre Occidental, what you see is a forest that's really dense. So everything is basically covered in foliage and there's no room to live. But here and there, there's rock outcrops. And on those rock outcrops, you'll find peridotes growing with no competition at all.
Yeah.
So it kind of seems like these rock outcrops in the tropics were probably little arid microsites where the plants could evolve adaptations to living in a high light or dry environment. And then as the deserts kind of opened up more recently, these plants, you know, they were quote unquote pre-adapted. Not that they had any kind of foresight,
right?
But they had the X adaptations that they needed to be successful in that habitat. And then they come down off of the rocks and kind of inhabit those new climates.
That is so cool to think about, these like sort of tentative steps into new territory based on some weird quirk of the historical origin points. And it just goes to show you that, you know, the biotic context matters, but the biotic context can change too. And that in and of itself can drive some pretty strange radiations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting idea to think about with pyridyl. It might, of course, it might be just an exceptional case of something that, you know, a desert lineage that evolved by X adaptation to these arid microsites in the tropics. But if you think about a lot of lineages of desert plants actually have sister relationships with things that are found on rock cliffs in the tropics. And a lot of others have sister relationships with plants that are epiphytic, which is another kind of arid microclimate in the tropics. It's sort of like a little microclimate that encourages, you know, C4 or CAM or other adaptations to a desert lifestyle.
Right.
So if you think about Echinocereus, the common cactus lineage that's found on the ground in deserts, down in the tropics you find it, but it's only found on kind of vertical rock cliff environments. There's other plant, you know, other types of cacti are actually epiphytic, but cacti are sort of special case.
Right.
There's other plants in the, you know, in the Boraginaceae, like Nema, that are really common on rocks down in these tropical environments and are really important desert annuals. And the case is similar for a lot of composites, a lot of different groups within this North American sunflower clade sort of have that. And, you know, it might be a more general case, I don't know. And I thought about this, and actually I gave talk about some of these ideas at the Binational Symposium organized by Jose Delgadillo in Ensenada. But there was a visiting an ecologist there from Ciudad de México named Noah Flores, who kind of, he pulled me aside and he said, hey, there's this paper you have to read. And he sent it to me. It's from the 1970s, and it's by Daniel Axelrod. It's one of his less known papers, but it's called Edaphic Aridity as a Factor in Angiosperm Evolution. And what he describes in this paper is an idea that he formulated from visiting Brazil in an area where there's a lot of lowland tropical rainforest, and then there's these big emergent kind of sandstone rocks, and there's full-on tropical forest below, but on these rocks, there's a lot of diversity of acacia and cacti and a lot of other desert lineages. So he kind of formulates an idea for how desert lineages may have arisen by X adaptation to arid microsites in the tropics based on that. But actually, he has a kind of more general view. You know, one of the big questions in thinking about plant evolution is that abominable mystery of Darwin, where all of the huge diversity of angiosperm lineages, they all seem to just appear all of a sudden in the geological record. And at a certain point, this was considered, you know, maybe a problem for the theory of evolution by natural selection. But if you think about where new plant lineages might arise, they probably arise in places with a lot of selective pressure, you know.
Sure.
Like little dry microsites or in alpine climates. And those are also places where fossilization is really rare. So, you know, if suddenly the climate changes and all of these things living in the alpine or living in the dry places can come down, it might look in the geological record like they just appear on the scene all of a sudden. It's kind of an interesting hypothesis.
Yeah, I really like that idea. And then a lot of different questions can be applied here. And you know, just think of the diversity of plants that have done this or something similar to this. That is really cool to think about. And who would have thought, you know, you're walking around looking at these plants growing up in these cliff faces, these little rock daisies that aren't all that well known. So much awesome ideas and food for thought can come out of this.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more to explore here. In these radiations that have occurred in the different desert regions, there's a lot of diversity of these things, and they also, you know, are found on really divergent ecologies. So now what I'm trying to do is to visit a lot of these sites and really get a good handle of what kind of rocks they're living on to see if there's been, in addition to geographic isolation, any ecological speciation on the different rock types. We'll see that I've started to piece together, you know, some data, but it's very tentative. And the reason why is because from the molecular data I have, I still have, you know, quite a bit of uncertainty towards the tips about relationships among particular species. So at the same time that I'm collecting more ecological information, I'm trying to get more genetic information using new techniques that are being developed for the composite by Jen Mendel and Vicky Funk and colleagues at the Smithsonian Institution and elsewhere, to try and study these plants and, you know, really get into the thick of how they radiated in this area.
So yeah,
that could be a future conversation we can talk about.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is something I definitely want to keep my finger on the pulse of. This is super cool. So, you know, you're out there looking at all these plants. There's what you said, over 80 different species of Peridolia.
Well, there's 84 species in the Rock Daisy tribe.
Okay.
But there's 5 different genera in this tribe.
Oh, okay.
And the biggest one is Peridolia, which has about 68 species. The other 4 genera, each of them have about from 1 to 3 species each.
Okay.
And one of them is very anomalous. It's a monotypic genus called Lycapsis that's found on an island about 120 miles off the coast of Chile.
Oh, all right.
But the other ones are, you know, there's actually a genus endemic to Baja California, Amaria, that is really interesting. And then there's a common shrub, a widespread shrub, actually, Pericomi caudata, that you can see in a wide diversity of different areas in the West that is also found in this tribe.
Awesome. So do you personally, in exploring all of this, have any favorites or particular incidences that make you gravitate towards one species over another?
I really like the ones that are very specialized and difficult to get to because, you know, you put so much work into it and then you get this amazing reward, which is this plant. One of the plants that's up there on my list is called Peridolia inuensis, and it's found in the southern Inyo Mountains of Eastern California. And when I first started doing fieldwork on this group, it was the first plant that I went to go look for. And the reason why is because right in the middle of its small range is a mountain called Conglomerate Mesa that has been slated for an open pit gold mining project, which would effectively slice the range of this endemic plant in half. When I went to go visit the plant, it was also the first time that I noticed that it was only found on this weird kind of blue rock. And at that point, I was more interested in collecting the rocks for my garden because I thought they were cool colors and be fun to put them among my plants in my garden. But it was only later that I met some geologists who said, oh, that's a specific kind of limestone that's found in Eastern California in little pockets.
Wow.
And I remember taking a map of, you know, the collections, known collections of Peridolia in that area, and the map of that rock type, and they kind of just matched perfectly.
Wow.
So I just consider that plant really interesting. And then the projects that are going on to conserve Conglomerate Mesa, including the floristic study by Maria Jesus and Naomi Fraga at RSA.
Oh, nice.
Have been good to follow. And it's just a really beautiful area too.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that all of this work can combine to do something to protect this plant and its habitat, of course.
Yeah.
Well, Isaac, this is incredible. I can really fully understand now why these plants have totally captured your imagination and have consumed your graduate studies. If people want to stay on track with what you're doing or just, you know, reach out and learn more from you or anything really, how do you recommend they find out more about you and your work?
Well, so I'm not active on Twitter at this point, but I could be. I have a Twitter account, which you can share. I have an Instagram where I post pictures of active fieldwork. And I'm also trying to be more active on iNaturalist. So I could use the help of the community in identifying plants that I encounter on these, you know, hard to get to environments. There's a lot of interesting things there. I'm interested to, you know, tap into that community resource. So maybe you can link to my, whatever you call it, screen name in those different mediums on the webpage.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, just for listening, what do you go by? Do you go by one name?
I go by California_naturalist.
Awesome. Well, that's easy yeah. enough. I can't believe you cornered that one, but good job.
Well, Matt, thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you for running such a successful program.
Oh, thanks.
And thank you also to, you know, all the people who have helped, a lot of people have helped out with this research. I'm really thankful to my mentors, especially Bruce Baldwin, as well as Vicky Funk and Carl Rothfels and Michael Powell himself. And I've also been supported in doing this research by a lot of different organizations including California Native Plant Society and American Society of Plant Taxonomists and Society for Systematic Biologists. So I appreciate all of that help, especially the help from all of the field biologists and all of my collaborators on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Awesome. Well, I mean, it's a great work. It's fascinating. It's important, not only just to understand life, but to help do something to maybe protect or safeguard some of it. But keep it up and definitely keep in touch, because this is a story I think is way worth diving into more. And you're welcome back anytime. So thanks again.
All right.
All right, man. Cheers. Who knew that a bunch of daisy relatives growing on cliffs throughout the southwestern portions of North America could teach us so much about evolution and adaptive radiation? I thank Isaac for enlightening us about this, and it's incredible that he gets to spend his time doing this kind of work. As always, I've posted all of the relevant links in the show notes to this episode, so make sure you go over to indefensiveplants.com/podcast and check those out as well, so you can stay up to date with all of the cool research coming out about pyridylite. Thank you to everyone who listens to this podcast, but I have a couple specific shout-outs to give today. Big thank you to Griff and Paul. Those are two of our most recent producers on this podcast, because they went over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and became patrons at the producer credit level. So thanks to people like Griff and Paul and all of the other incredible folks who have donated to this podcast, I can continue making this well into the future. I literally could not be doing these efforts without your support, so thank you all so very much. Again, that's patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And if you want a little extra, like say a cool long sleeve shirt or hoodie, because if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, we're heading into fall here, it's going to start getting cool. There's also plenty of short sleeve options if you live in the Southern Hemisphere and you're heading into summer, but all of those can be found over at teespring.com/stores/indefensiveplants. And the best part is they're all customizable, and a portion of every purchase you make over there is being donated to the Rainforest Trust. So helping to buy up land and protect prime rainforest habitat into the future. Other than that, stay tuned. Hit that subscribe button. So many great things on the horizon. I mean that. I'm so lucky to talk to so many incredible people each and every week, and I really like sharing that with you guys. So again, hit that subscribe button to stay on top of it, and tell your friends. We want to get more people listening, because plant blindness is real, and one of the best ways to get ourselves out of this climate crisis situation is a plant-based focus on conservation. Until next week, this is your host Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.